Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We have on with us right now Sandy Freese, life coach, therapist, and also co-host. Sandy and I today will be, are scheduled to be interviewing Lawrence Drank and Lynn Espale, two formerly incarcerated individuals who survived the abuses of power by the overseers in uniform. Both of the guests will explain what led to prison, what they experienced while incarcerated, their experiences once released, and their now mission to bring awareness to the public and to help others, both bringing awareness of the injustices within the penal system and ways in which people of compassion can be supportive in helping both those released and the victims of mass incarceration still inside. So right now, while we are waiting for Lawrence to come on the air, I want to introduce Sandy Freese. Sandy, can you talk a little bit about what you do? And I believe Lawrence just came on with us. But Sandy, if you
Great.
Can explain a little bit about what you do, and then we can have Lawrence. Is this Lawrence on with us or Lynn?
No, this is Lawrence, the 805.
Okay. Yes. Welcome aboard once again, Lawrence.
Thank you.
Sandy's going to talk a little bit about her, what she does, and then I'd like to have you come on. Also, Lynn Espale is supposed to be on with us as well. So both of you will be having a chance to talk a little bit about what your experiences were. So, Sandy, do you want to really quickly introduce yourself, and then Lawrence?
Sure. Sandy Freese. I live in Indiana. I have a business called Victory from Chaos. I am accredited in cognitive behavioral therapy and neurolinguistic programming. I am a justice advocate in that I receive cases and I go through cases to sort what is going to be beneficial. And when I find that, I send it forward to one who may be able to help this incarcerated individual. You know, many are innocent, but they're spending years and years behind bars. So that's what I do there. I work with people who are incarcerated, just talking to them on a daily basis, writing letters, and family members of incarcerated, trying to give them a good positive starting point. You can find Victory from Chaos, either victoryfromchaos.com on the web or through my Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter. Lawrence, you ready?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, so my name is Lawrence Drank. I'm a former incarcerated of 20 years in state prison in California. I'm a product of the system since 9 years old. I've been in several group homes and foster homes and California Youth Authority. I'm currently the founder and owner of Legacy Programs Education and Reentry, and we focus on educating the family members, the community, and the offender of what real needs need to be met in order for a successful reentry, and not just that, but a permanent reentry where there's no We focus on the recidivism rate. We offer life coaches and any type of behavior tool or any type of education as far as like why behavior, the behaviors we have, the beliefs, and we give people the power back and their ultimately their voice. And we live by the motto that you are not your crime. And that everyone deserves a second chance as long as they put in the work and effort in order to be successful, and that something should not be held against them, and because nobody's perfect, and so that's just my goal, is working with family members, offenders, and hopefully soon correctional officers, and help them train how to deal with people.
We're going to get into
fantastic.
All that. We're going to get into all that now. I just wanted to introduce, I wanted to have you introduce yourself to the audience as to a little bit about your background. And I want to say, Lawrence, again, I'm very proud of the accomplishments you made. I want you also to know that as we make accomplishments, as we try to do the best we can, we, especially with you now being a formal pastor, you're going to run up against a lot of resistance, because we know we're fighting spirits, the evil and the good and evil, and sometimes we have to be strong in these areas, and hopefully God will get us through them. But I think the audience is pretty familiar with you and also with Lynn through the interviews that you've been doing. We have Lynn and we have Sandy Freeze and Miriam Jacobs on with us every Wednesday morning from 9 in the morning till 10:30 Eastern Daylight Time. We've been having Lawrence on with us every Sunday afternoon from 3:30 to 5:30 every Sunday afternoon, so that he can talk about his experiences, his achievements, his goals. And he's come a long way being out. He has become a pastor, and he can talk to you about it. Lawrence, do you want to tell them about it?
Sure. So when I got released, they released me with no tools. They released me with nothing that would be part of a successful reentry. And so they did no ID, no birth certificate. I mean, I literally, if it wasn't for my wife and for my my circle, I would have none of the success that I have today. So with that is I created my legacy program. I became ordained, and I believe that a spiritual nature needs to be addressed and needs to be nurtured through action. And so that's what I've been working on lately, is just trying to leave people, places, things better than I found them. And I didn't think I was ever going to be ordained. Everyone said I was going to be a minister one day, but, you know, I thought that it wasn't possible. And by the grace of God, today I am. I didn't have a business when I came out. I just created it within a 90-day period. And I had good people around me to assist and to guide, really. And that's what gave me my idea about my business, is about it's one thing to tell somebody what to do, but it's another to show them how it's done. And I think once you show somebody how to do something, it's going to be very successful in everything how they go forward. It's like telling a child to clean up his room, but not giving any example of how to clean the room. So, like I said, I was released with nothing. I was expected to fail. And I just persevered and had faith in God that it was going to be okay. No. And
It's one day at a time, isn't it, really? One day at a time. And you know, something that I believe strongly in, too, is that when I wake up in the mornings, I think I want to do something today that is going to give me a good night's sleep tonight. And you know, I wake up at 4 a.m. every morning, and I know you're an early riser too, because there's a lot to be done, and your passion drives you. And I've seen how your passion has driven you to not give up, to continue on, because what you're doing, Lawrence, really what you're doing is so important and beneficial to people who have been where you have been or are where you have been, giving them the hope that when they're released, they're not going to struggle because of the things you've had to struggle for. Because I understand part of what you're doing also is to make sure that they have help in gaining the things they need, such as their birth certificates and all of that. So you're giving them a good place to jump off, right?
Absolutely. We call it launching somebody off, as my pastor did with me in a 90-day period. And how they nurtured and encouraged me to move forward, I just kind of wanted to give that to everyone should have a Nielsen experience. And that's what I call it. And, you know, I could sit here and feel sorry for myself and just be like, poor me, and be a victim of circumstance, or I could rise above and I could sit there and show how I want to do a job that nobody else wants to do. That's the only reason I'm successful in what I do and why it's a good idea, because nobody's really wanting to put in the time and effort. As being incarcerated, I lived with the incarcerated my whole life. I was raised by them. So I have a desire and a drive to make it where what I went through, somebody else doesn't have to.
And
turning tragedy into triumph.
That's it. I mean, I think that if everybody did that, it would be a better place where instead of having a selfish motive of how can I make it better for myself right now, I just accept my terms and conditions and I move forward making sure that I keep in mind what's needed in that time of tragedy to later be triumphant. You know, I have to sit there and figure out what needs to be fixed. And it's by embracing what's broken. Really, that's just it's something that I'm not used to. Normally, I sit there and allow other people to dictate my character from my environment and to sit there and feel sorry for myself. And I think once I hit my 30s, I just kind of grew up some and said, you know, I'm tired of this. I'm taking charge.
Good deal. And a lot of people are going to benefit.
I hope so. I mean, if I could sit there and just take a fraction of pain and suffering out of what's going on in the system, then I think I'm successful no matter what. And, you know, being out 90 days and starting a business, getting ordained, and securing my future and taking charge isn't heard of. But the thing is I have good people in my life to help me with that. And I think that's what's missing in the world today with people that are coming out from the being incarcerated is that they have this disconnect from society. And it begins not just when they get out, but as they're being incarcerated. It starts in there because you're told that you no longer belong to society. And I want to give that back to them. I want to give them the opportunity to be part a citizen, even though they're incarcerated, and having the community reach out to them where by the time they do get out, they have the support necessary and the encouragement to go forward where they don't have to the issues of looking back. I think if I had issues of when I got out, if I focused all my issue on getting a job, having shelter, eating, where I'm going to sleep, where I'm going to eat, who's going to accept me, I wouldn't be where I'm at today.
Without organizations like yours, people get out, and like you say, with barely nothing. You know, I've been interviewing a lot of people for this book I'm working on. They get out with basically nothing, and they're defeated from the very beginning of their release. So, without having a safe circle to become a member of, this is exactly why our recidivism rates in the United States are so strikingly high. Because, of course, with nothing, they're going to return to the way of life that they had before. They don't have a choice. So, you know, this is why these organizations and businesses that are trying to make a difference are so needed. So, you know, Lawrence, kudos to you for not giving up, for getting your head, wrapped around positivity and optimism, and, you know, your desire to help other people is really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. And you do a whole lot for everybody, too. I mean, it's very important that we all do our part and be part of a bigger picture other than ourselves. Because I could sit here and make my home really nice, or I could sit here and make my community a better place to where my home shines through that community. And that's kind of like the approach that I have with legacy. You know, when I got out, it wasn't this easy. Nothing was simple. It was for the first 2 weeks, I had emotion overload. I still suffered from PTSD. Everything that came out of my mouth was, I'll just go back to prison. It was easier there. And I adopted this almost as prison was a crutch. And that's not, it is my fault, but also it's the prison's fault too, because of the conditioning that they have us under. And, you know, I'm challenging that today. I'm going to get these guys. I want these guys free, even though they're locked up. They need to be spiritually and mentally and emotionally free and not be driven by their traumatic childhoods. And, you know, locking up and putting someone away, I don't believe is the answer. You have to educate them in the process and relate that to the community, make them part of the success of these individuals going in, our loved ones, and give them every tool possible so when they do get out, they already have a head start. And if I would have got this 6 months before I got out and I was properly educated, I think my reentry would have been a whole lot easier. But the system didn't make it easy. They didn't let me parole to my home, which I am now. I just got here last week. So I'm back with my son and my wife.
So happy for you guys.
Thank you. Fortunately, I had an understanding parole officer that helped me work on terms and conditions and to push the transfer. But the problem I had was in prison, they didn't try to transfer me to my family. They paroled me homeless. And I had to scratch and dig for a place to stay. Fortunately, I have good relations where my pastor and his wife took me in, and the Bethel family adopted me. But the problem with this is that they did not set me up for success. They wanted me to go back. And I feel today it's a conflict of interest on what they're offering those guys, because it's just sending – it's making it easy. It's not giving them anything to think about. And then when they come out here, there's unrealistic expectations that, you know, everything I was prepared for inside prison, everything failed when I got out. Everything. There's no program that they offered – that actually applies out here. They told me that I could get money, I could get housing, I could get all the essentials, and they absolutely lied about it. And yet nobody to this day is being held accountable for that. And that's wrong. They just sit there and say, well, you know, you're doing all right. Yeah, but, you know, the struggle with that, you know, the beautiful came out of that struggle. So, you know,
and some people are not going to be released and be as fortunate to have people wanting to help them. So, you know, so that's a great deal of what you're going to accomplish, because you're going to give these individuals that have no hope, hope.
Absolutely. I believe God provides and he will give us examples and people in our lives to help guide his people. I just feel unfortunate about the system, how they're as much as they want, they say, like, especially in California, CDCR, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I want to know where the rehabilitation is. You know, I rehabilitate myself because of the outside influences that I had, such as my wife and my son and people that depended on me coming out and being successful. I think that really needs to be challenged today, and the people that have that influence really need to start considering alternative options. You know, something I think that when you – I was at this one prison where they had the it was a good environment. You know, it was still prison, but it was a good environment. And I think that was one of the most successful programs that I was part of, to where I was able to make good choices and decisions, and I was able to – relearn my behavior in a safe environment. And in some prisons, you can't do that, you know, especially the out of state ones. Those are bad too. And I think that when we give these guys an opportunity to be in a safe zone where they can walk away from a fight and they're not driven by prison politics and the conditioning that the COs and the system creates to keep us chained and against each other and dependent on them, I just think that more needs to be done. So I speak out.
That's amazing. Leona may have had to take a call, so I'm going to just continue speaking with you. You know, you talked before about how when you're incarcerated, you're basically molded into being a prisoner. You didn't use those exact words, but I want to talk a little bit about that, because some of the people, you know, that I've been recently speaking with, you know, some have been in facilities where they had a television in their cell. They were able to go outside and play basketball until it got dark. One person even, I mean, they had a pool room, so they could play pool. You know, but then the stark difference is the other people that I've spoken with are not even allowed to hold a letter from a loved one, or, I mean, they're in their cells 24 hours a day, 23 hours a day and are allowed to get out once a day. One person I spoke with said he was allowed to have a 15-minute shower once a week. You know, the lights come on and go off. There's no control over that. And this last individual I spoke with just yesterday, he said, life is so hard out here. He's living in a state by himself. No family members are close. He said, it's so hard out here. Sometimes I think it would be easier just to go back because I know what to expect.
Yeah.
And yet it was horrible in there, and it's horrible out here. So, yeah.
Well, especially with the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you to speak on that.
I think that the system is very inconsistent. They have here, you'll have rehabilitation one place and not the other, and it needs to be a universal fit because, and not only that, but the approach has to be, the data has to back it up. It has to be viewed on what's going to be successful, not what's going to make more money or what's going to cost the state less. And like I said, the conditions in prison, it's a like a mental disconnect, emotional disconnect from being a human being. Unless you have somebody that's there to show you love and respect and compassion, you know, those guards aren't meant to they're there to do their job. But more importantly, they're not there to put their thumb down on us. And that's what they do. You know, it's turned into a place where you go for punishment to now you're in a place where you're judged all over again every day
yes,
of your life.
And I may be wrong, but I thought the reason people are taken out of society, that is the punishment, being taken out of society. Unfortunately, it doesn't end there.
No.
And a lot of these COs are not trained to understand that. So they have a lot of them. I understand are ex-military persons. So they come home from the military, and they get a job as a CO. Well, they have that military mentality, so they're going to treat these incarcerated citizens just like they treated people when they were in the military, and even worse. You know, I've heard stories about COs inciting violence between prisoners. So they, you know, they'll take something from someone's room and they'll say, I think he did it, but I don't know for sure. And that starts a fight. And so, you know, they're inciting these terrible things that are happening in there.
And they know what they're doing because they have to. They're outnumbered. They're out of shape. To be a correctional officer these days, at least in CDCR, you only have to have a high school diploma. And the problem with that is that they're conditioned just as a regular gang member is growing up through the ranks is they're packing on over familiarity and how to not we're not allowed to ask how was your weekend or how's the you know what are you doing this weekend or hey you have a nice day. Their packet on over familiarity is so much thicker than the one on training for mental health because Their training for mental health is so is just so minute compared to what they do to teach to protect themselves. And you know, back in the days, there used to be a standard of being a CO. They did their job. They were correctional officers. They were security. Today, they are not like that. You have criminals that are COs. You have guys that have no business having authority, but there's mm-hmm. also good ones out there today too. I mean, there's several. I saved a good one's life from a cart falling on her back in 2014. So I don't think they're all bad, but I think the training, if it was by outside organizations rather than the inside, that the approach would be different. Just like right now, where the pandemic, they get away with murder, literally. You know, from the prison I was at, there were six guys that died from the COVID. And let me tell you something. Inmates aren't getting COVID. They're not going nowhere. The COs are bringing that in. The free staff are bringing that in. And they're not being held accountable.
So,
right. I mean, we've been shut down for over a year now. The United States has been shut down, basically, the prisons, for over a year. And yet there are still new cases of COVID coming up. So they have to be coming from an outside source.
Well, and they're not following the federal guidelines. They're getting away with it because of the union. And nobody's speaking up. But, you know, I will give, you know, everyone wants to know how. So I have a friend of mine that he's a very well-written person. And his name is Franklin Lee. He's in one of the prisons I was at. And I wanted to read something that he wrote to me about the COVID experience, if you guys don't mind.
Oh, that'd be beautiful.
Okay. So this is when they, in the midst of the COVID right now, and it says, the area I was in was lit up with a soft glow of TVs illuminating each bunk, hidden behind as they were by torn sheets. As each occupant sought out the only comfort they had left, bunks were lined up 7 by 7 and towering over 6 feet high. Those seeking escape within their dreams were laid out on the peaks, staring at the web-like cluttered metal slats of the ceiling. This was no refugee camp. This was quarantine. On December 2019, Wuhan, China was the epic center of a new outbreak of disease, the coronavirus. Within months, the entire world faced a pandemic with massive quarantine zones, enforced curfews, new guidelines for masks, social distancing, and isolation in place. A year later, the world is still devastated by the impact of COVID-19. With vaccines only on the horizon or beginning to roll out, the result of the virus has left massive death tolls, exhausted the supply of emergency workers, PPEs, and left a long-lasting psychological trauma in its wake. I was awakened at 1 a.m. Get up, get your blues on, and bring only your bedroll and hygiene, the officer ordered. You are moving to quarantine. By 2 a.m., nearly 30 of us were ushered into a small gym on the lower yards at Mill Creek State Prison, where 35 camp cots with new mattresses were laid out 6 feet apart with minimal instructions except for stay in your beds. We were down for the night. It was the first night of quarantine. While COVID-19 spread rapidly through the United States, California prisons, which are already overcrowded, attempted to relieve the pressure with a trickled release of inmates who had minimum incarceration time left. If COVID-19 were to materialize on prison grounds, the wildfire would engulf the population in a matter of days. The second day of quarantine on AR Gym was just bearable. Our brand new cots and mattresses were replaced by old metal bunk beds to make way for the flow of incoming COVID patients. Of my pod of 66 inmates, 90% were in quarantine. Half were housed in the isolation building or ADSEG, and the rest of us were in the gym, a recreation facility that the federal government had ordered closed to inmate housing. We were given KN95 masks since our cloth ones were worthless and extra clothes. The medical representative came in and explained the COVID symptoms, percentages of who recovered and who had died from the virus. He emphasized that there were no vaccines at this time, yet our bodies were fighting it from within. We just had to wait out the storm. For months, California Department of Corrections Rehabilitation had attempted to prepare prisons for such an event. We stood diligently and obediently, enforcing social distancing amongst ourselves, wearing masks, living under a modified program and quarantine zones, with a complacency not truly felt. All outside workers were tested daily, supposedly. Nothing would breach our walls, and we remained vigilant to those who were sick with coughs and colds. Contact with the outside world was limited to letters, phone calls, and occasional video visits. We had zero cases at first. When there was a false positive among staff, CDCR quickly responded, isolating them and the inmate workers who were around them. Then later in November, the cough started. Some had chills or a fever, others had body aches, and the cough started. Late November, the cough started, and some had chills, fever, others had body aches, and became bedridden. I had lost my sense of smell and taste. What was the thought to have been a common cold turned quickly into a circus of COVID testing, lockdowns, and many hours later, a mass round of COVID positive cases. Some were removed by that afternoon, others later that night, and more in the early a.m. hours. All of this just a prelude of the discombobulated cell moves as time progressed. The second night in the gym, one inmate was heaving, gasping for air, and carted out to the hospital. We were all shaken up by the remains strong for one another. Unfortunately, in here, we will never find out the result of his condition. Neither would his family until it seemed dire. CDCR would attempt to remain quiet about the inmate conditions as long as they were able. The medical representative returned later and revised his previous statement that only half of us had tested positive and the rest inconclusive. This meant that we had to be separated again, and the positive cases would move to another gym, other positive cases. At 10 p.m. that night, we had to pack up again and had our second move, this time to B-Yard Gym. The gym was already occupied with level 3 and 4 inmates who were COVID positive and in the EOP program, which is the Enhanced Outpatient Program, a program for inmates who were mentally unstable, disabled, or extremely medicated, usually housed separately from the general population. As we marched single file, miserable, cold, and sick, our complaints went unheard. Custody staff blamed it solely on medical, who overrode their decisions regarding COVID tests, COVID-positive inmates, housing. Later, medical stated that it was custody's call, which is typically within CDCR. The situation was soon to get worse, as level 3-4 inmates are not supposed to be housed with lower custody inmates, according to California State Law Title 15. With the gym crammed with bunks from on end to the other, the current occupants had established their place on most of the lower bunks. Though custody had assigned beds, the inmates refused to move. Soon raised voices and hard posturing occurred, and the situation of sick and angry inmates exploded. Quickly, the alarm sounded. A string of officers in riot gear filled in with batons extended, pepper sprays propped, and even block guns cocked. They surrounded the gym and escorted each of us out into the ice-chilled night, seating us on the cold concrete slab of the basketball court. Custody eyes were glaring at us, first clenching weapons as they weeded out the loudmouths and troublemakers. After the sergeant berated us about how the situation was not good for anyone, as if we were the cause of the illegal housing, we were escorted back to our assigned bunks. Sitting on top of our bunks, we were observed the temperature of the situation. While most of the level 3-4 inmates were toward the back, the rest of us were in the center. A few settled down, but some kept their shoes on, just in case things got off. After a few more puffed chests and even a comment of wait until custody leaves, the tension slowly faded into the night. The next morning, hostilities were still present, but no boundaries were pushed. Everyone knew CDCR violated guidelines by housing different levels together, and it would only be a matter of time before the warden would intervene. Various phone calls from families were sent to the warden, governor, and even the ACLU and other major organizations. By mid-morning, my group made our third exodus to the next gym, C Yard. While maintenance was in the process of bolting down 50 bunk beds into the concrete floor for 6 hours, we waited outside, unable to lie down, sitting around the few picnic tables available, hungry, cold, exhausted, sick, and limited on movement. We could only move from our seats on benches or ground to go to the outdoor toilet facilities. And this only by permission and in groups of two or three. A few were really sick, still coughing and feverish, yet there was no place for them to rest. We were later joined by our other group and filled the entire gym. This quarantine zone was the worst place of all. This gym was very frigid, with swamp coolers blasting cold outside air inward on full blast. There was limited hot water in the showers, and the toilets and sinks leaked. Dust, dirt, and muck were everywhere. The place had not been cleaned prior to our arrival. These were the conditions in which we were living. In a country of such rich technology and vital economy, we were like refugees in a war-torn country carved inside a dingy gym in a state that boasts the world's fifth highest economy. With minimum food, freezing temperatures, 24-hour illumination, and barely adequate cleaning supplies. Added to that was a mismatch of bunks, some 6 feet tall, what once housed a triple bunk, but now without the middle bed. Scalding to the top bunk, this was no way to treat a sick person. With one bad roll in the night, it would not be COVID that I needed to worry about, but a 5.5-foot drop to the concrete floor. In the dimly lit gym, rows of beds lined up with a grid pattern of on the once upon a time basketball court. Several glowed with a TV hidden behind a tin of sheets like little houses. Each day we counted down the time until we could return to our cells. The temperature did not surpass 57, and the vents remained open. Even with the blankets we put up covering them after a week and the persistent phone calls from concerned families, action began to take place. Vents were shut off. The water temperature for the shower rose from cold to lukewarm when all nozzles were on. More blankets were passed out for us to layer up, but nothing further was provided. Not everyone who tested positive was gathered in a gym. We were housed with several who tested negative, and those with bad health conditions, such as diabetes, heart disease, COPD, and other ailments. Yet we were packed in an overcrowded gym in unbearable conditions, which only exacerbated the issue. The authorities were full of contradictions. The medical representatives made a point that everyone needed to be hydrated and Pedialyte was offered every day. Yet nurses refused to hand them out. They refused to enter the premises. Whatever became of the Hippocratic Oath? Everything said was noncommittal. Such as length of stay or why we were moved. Everyone was short-fused and exhausted. We were tired from the ill-treatment and inhumane conditions, and more were coming. As the fatigue and settled in, morale plummeted, not just us, but also among custody and medical staff. Then the fear and anger struck. At first, medical staff were compassionate and personal with each of us, accommodating each of our needs, offering sympathetic care and supplies, medicine and electrolyte to stay healthy. As the days dragged on, conversations were short and supplies dried up. Most stayed out of the gym, providing medical and temperature checks outside in the cold air. For the rest of us, our morale was crumbling fast. The bitter conditions had made a few desperate for comfort of old habits. Thievery ran rampant through the gym, with many accusations being made, leading to constant confrontation. With lack of space, adequate care, sleep, and supplies, a brewing pot of a volcano is set to explode. We are truly forced into a vagrant lifestyle, traveling with meager belongings, living out of a packed box, and uprooted from our comfort of home. Some slept in sheltered tents of sheet-draped bunks, others dealing with the inclement weather of frigid air and gray snow fluttering down from the rafters, adding to the layer of dust and debris. A jailhouse sparrow trapped inside flutters above while we sleep in full gear in attempt to contain body heat. In 1 week, the COVID cases skyrocketed at Mill Creek State Prison to 394 positive cases and one death. From the information we could collect from our families and staff, all gyms had become quarantine zones at capacity. Mill Creek State Prison had become the third highest contagious prison in California next to San Quentin. Unfortunately, CDCR had not been ready for the pandemic, even with over 6 months of preparation. In June, Northern California prisons were free of COVID, with only a few Southern California prisons initially infected. A decision was made to transfer quarantine COVID-negative inmates to Northern prisons to reduce the spread. Why was this even considered? Even though several protests and arguments against the transfers continued, the first move to San Quentin was made. It backfired. Within 2 weeks, San Quentin, which had zero cases, surpassed 1,000 for 6 months. CDCR had plenty of time to learn from their mistakes. And yet inmates at Mill Creek State Prison and other facilities continued to pay the price. Quarantine zones were not ready, and guidelines to prevent the virus from entering the grounds became lax. Free staff and custody staff were not checked adequately at their entrance point. The transfers within the prison yards was mind-boggling and made no sense. And CDCR soon knew they had made another mistake. After a week, very little change. The gym was still in an icebox. Even with the vents being silenced, the temperature rose only to about 10 degrees. The reality of the virus was set in. Those who had little to do resorted to conspiracy theories such as who brought it in, fear that the last flu shot was the real virus source. Depression became a constant companion for most. Just lying there in bed and sleeping through everything was their only remedy. Even the little sparrow which fluttered above throughout the day died an accidental or suicidal fate with a ceiling fan. Anger flared between inmates in custody as conditions and treatment worsened. To retaliate for those who refused vital checks, the breakfast cart was left in the cold outside air until everyone completed the routine checkups. This was typical CDCR response. Punish everyone with a cold food and indifference just because of a few. One serious ill inmate had been bedridden for days, had skipped meals and his daily medication, and was mostly ignored. If he was checked on, it was only for count time. Other inmates had to provide the wellness check and spoke up when he was found to be getting worse. Finally, he was admitted to the hospital. Almost a week later, he returned and stated that he had almost died. Within our families, friends, and concerned community, we may never have survived the quarantine zone. Phone calls from our family and friends have flooded the warden and governor's office about the inhumane conditions. Other gyms, such as on the upper yards, had no phone access, and their families were left in the dark on anything happening at Mill Creek State Prison. At that time, even the CDCR website was down, unable to provide any information. Their typical response, everyone was being cared for through either a captain, sergeant, or even an ADA, which is American Disability Act representative, who were supposed to visit daily, had not made an appearance all week. There was no mention of our situation on the news, and families had no ideas what was happening. What was being complained about was contradicted by administration. Most was about the poor conditions of the reckless planning for the crisis. Most felt that if we would have been quarantined in our cells, the spread of the virus would have been contained and no hostilities would have occurred. As one inmate stated, we were already serving the punishment for our crimes from the justice system. Why are we further punished by staff when this was not our fault? After 2 weeks of quarantine, we were relieved to be finally leaving the gym and returning to the upper yards. Although the institution was quick in the beginning to transfer us to the gym in droves, the trickle back was slow and lengthy. Groups of eight were sent every 4 to 6 hours for the next 3 days. Once again, no further information was provided, yet we all stood at attention awaiting our turn. As quickly as a group left, more filtered in from the other yards. On the third day, in the last group, we finally made it out of the quarantine zone. only to be sent by another yard and housed in a temporary pod. Once again, transferred to another placement without a clue of what's going on, the status of our property, or if we would return to our original cells. With a whole new set of medical staff, we were angered by their redundant procedures wanting to retest us. We already have COVID and fear of more quarantine. The bureaucratic mismatch of one hand not knowing what the other hand was doing continued, leading this institution of complete dumbfounding chaos. As we gathered with our fellow prisoners to share our experiences from the other quarantine gyms, their stories were just as tragic. No access to showers or toilet facilities except to the porta potty during the day outside the gym, at nights with no bathroom available. Those in need of the lavatory used plastic bags. How is it that even close to sanitary? Showers were allowed every 3 days. They had no phone access or heat in the gym. Water was always cold, but situations were the same. Custody pushing the boundaries, and inmates trying to establish some kind of program to survive. The rest of us now immune to COVID were classified as critical workers or forced labor to volunteer and fill in the workforce, such as porters, yard crew, or kitchen help. While the institution was shut down, custody and free staff had to pick up the slack, especially in the kitchen, to feed everyone. Once we were freed, we were forced, not asked, and threatened with an RVR, which is rule violation report. If we did not comply, most were still exhausted from the transfers or just getting healthy. Anxiety over the status of our personal property or when we would return to our cells increased. Rumors spread faster than COVID about other inmates packing our property and stealing our things with lost, misplaced, or broken appliances. Those who did finally receive their property continued to live out of boxes and resigned preparation for another move. In a month's time, the positive cases peaked for inmates at 796, 315, with two deaths. The numbers were slowly decreasing. Still, approximately 10,000 inmates at California have tested positive for COVID. This experience has widened our perspectives on how unprepared CDCR was in a crisis and the reaction under pressure. Although in rehabilitation, they teach breaking down the stereotype and criminal mentality of us versus them, the continued mistreatment, mismanagement, and misinformation followed by the uncompassionate and uncaring way showed inmates that has caused much of the tension. We are inmates in their eyes, less than slaves, forced into labor, even when recovering. If sick, we were ignored. Whatever comforts we built for ourselves were easily torn down, such as sheets and window breakers and tents around bunks. Power and control between inmates in custody challenges each group in a constant struggle with no available solutions. Retaliation has been the trump to all conflicts. Inmates are made out to be unredeemable, seeking fault in all we do. If we complain, we are told we are not grateful. If we speak out, we are considered liars and disobedient ingrates. And yet, we are blamed for spreading the coronavirus. As each day continued, the merry-go-round of movement and transfers followed. Inmates were moved from one dorm to dorm, building to building, yard to yard, spreading the infection everywhere. The tapestry of CDCR has been confusing and illogical, further compounded by the frustration of the population. Anxiety and confusion grew towards administration, as no one sees anxiety and confusion grew towards administration, as no one seems to care that we were uprooted from our living situations every few days. With both custody inmates in the dark of all the decisions made by the administration. We all wonder what was worse, COVID-19 or the quarantine. Through this experience, the veracity of the people's true colors emerged on the inside. Those who handled the crisis either stood firm, or resorted to old habits. Compassion versus thievery. Kindness versus selfishness. Not everyone was prepared for the pandemic. Even in the public eye, inmates were continued to seem as unworthy. Inmates were continued to seen as unworthy for compassion for release, even the sick and elderly. Officials defied orders against the governor's commands and public opinion. As the vaccine becomes readily available to inoculate the prison population, the media panted the disgust pictures of inmates were before first responders. Once again, inmates were devoid of rights, corralled like cattle, and kept in complete ignorance. The true test of resiliency and integrity were the inmates themselves. Those who truly rose from their label proved to be more compassionate, helping the sick and elderly and giving those in need. It is those few who surprised us all by rising above their criminality, showing compassion, that makes me more appreciative towards them than anyone else in outside. And that was by my friend.
Lawrence, that was really tough to hear. Let's try to connect after the show. I know that I did get a couple of things from that, and it was very disheartening. But I do understand that in that letter he also said, because family members and loved ones continued to write and did not waver, things did change a bit. So what's important, yeah. I think people need to really understand, you don't give up. You don't give up on those that are incarcerated. If you're a family member or if you're a loved one, keep checking. Don't stop checking.
Well, and I think it's important.
Don't give up.
I want
for
to
everyone
add,
that's, go ahead.
I wanted to add something too. And Lawrence, while you were reading that, you know, I heard the pain in your voice, and this is something that the public doesn't realize, is that even though you are out of prison, you are still kind of like in prison, because you come out with all that you went through inside, and you're still kind of like a prison within yourself. And this is what I want the audience to know, this, because many of them probably do, but those of you that don't, once the prisoner goes into prison, they see so much, and they go through so much, talking about it. Now, Lawrence was just reading this thing about his friend, and he was breaking down himself. And Sandy, of course, I can see the pain in her, because she was also a victim years ago, not in prison, but people that have been through these things, they know. They feel that pain, because everybody in this world has something going on in their lives, many worse than others, and they're going through all these different traumas that they're trying to deal with. Lawrence being a traumatic, having traumas occur when he was 9 years old and growing up, he had to go through the same doggone trials and tribulations and traumas while behind bars when he's supposed to be getting rehabilitated. They're going through more abuse. And this is what the audience has to know. This is not something that will ever leave him completely, nor will it leave others. I know other prisoners, too, and I can give you their names. I'll have them on the show sometime, that have been through so much while in prison that they've been out for years, and they're still going through so much trauma over what they've experienced while inside.
And it pisses me off when people say, oh, well, you know, they want to do something, but they can't make a phone call. And this is the thing that about me is that, you know, those are my people. The incarcerated and the families of the incarcerated are my people. I'm very connected with them because I went through the corralling. I went through the same thing he went through. But to hear, you know, we thought that was just our prison. That's how disconnected we were from even other prisons. But it was universal. And this is not a California thing. This is a country, you know, and it pisses me off that they're getting away with modern day slavery. It's not right. At what point do we sit there and send somebody in prison where they come out the same? You know, this is supposed to be good for them. This is supposed to be where we get our help and get solutions to the problems. Instead, we just come out with the same damn problems. And, you know, the PTSD is ridiculous. You know, I still wash my boxers in the shower. The other day I rolled up my jeans and put them behind my pillow. It's just like little traits that aren't good, you know, and you know, we have to do more for our people. These are our loved ones. These are people that are helpless. You know, sure they committed a crime, but at what point does the judging end? At what point does the punishment end? Does it cease? You know, and yet we're still being punished for something. I'm still being punished for something I did 20 years ago. And it's like at some point we have to rise up and say, hey, you know what? We're going to put this on our own shoulders because we see that you're not able to do it. You know, the people going in with the same problems are coming out with the same problems as well. And we need to address that. And people want to turn a blind eye and think that, oh, they're locked up out of sight, out of mind. But let me tell you something. When that person moves next door to you and decides to go on a rampage, then you're going to wake up and go, oh, shit. Maybe I should have done something. Maybe I should have invested a little bit more. And it's not until tragedy happens when we sit there and want to try to fix something. And so that's why I take it upon myself to fix what I can and be a part of the solution.
Exactly. You know, I'm just going to be honest. I am a little bit emotional at this point. But I'm going to say this anyway. I have, you know, a Facebook group. It's called Injustice Reform and Reentry. My uncle, my blood uncle, he put on my group the other day, I said, I am so glad I am not the judge of man. And he said, well, my Bible says if... he said, my son turned gay, and my Bible says he has no hope of getting into heaven. I let it go for a day because I didn't want to respond until I was clear in my head exactly what I wanted to say. And I said, I understand that is how our family has been raised. However, can you really take it upon yourself to judge anybody else? Can you really say that because he's gay, he's going to hell? I'm going to hell because I got a divorce. That's what I've been told. So I said in the end, I said, I hope your son feels warmth, and I hope your son feels loved. And that was it. Then after he had a chance to see it and respond, I deleted the post because that's not what I'm about. I'm not gonna waste my time dealing with that. However, just a few days ago, I posted something else, and I said, you know, those who are incarcerated deserve a second chance. They must have a second chance. And he said, yeah, let them all come back home. We'll take care of them. They can live with us. We'll support them while they do nothing. We'll support them while they don't care about getting a job. And you know, he said, because after all, isn't it, Sandy, isn't it us white people that are the ones that did all the damage? Well, I immediately deleted the post and blocked my uncle. So what I'm saying is, I mean, I went a long way around it, but what I'm saying is there is still today, this racial and ethnic disparity that is the root of so much vindictiveness, judgment, and pain in the world. We have got to teach our children better than the way we were taught. We must.
Yes. Changes need to be made in this country. I say in this country because this country is the country that has the most concern of others in other countries. This country has the most negative issues going on, and it has to change. If we're going to be the leader of all countries, we need to gain the respect of people in other countries. And it's not happening as long as this country continues to abuse its own citizens that are incarcerated. That's another thing. We're the only country that takes away their citizens' rights to vote, the only country, when someone is incarcerated.
Well, and that goes further to what you were saying, is that, you know, when we leave prison, we still remain imprisoned. You know, we're conditioned as inmates out in the free world. And then everybody wonders why we go back to prison. And none of the nobody's being educated. Nobody's being made aware of the struggles that we have. And they think that that our punishment is fit. And it's the thing is that you're so oppressed and behind those walls that you're gaining a resentment towards society and further distancing yourself, feeling out of place and out of touch. And unless you're going to have somebody there to help you with that struggle, you're going to get lost. You're going to turn into that monster that you're being labeled. And then everyone, yep, figures, checks out, you know, he was meant to go back. And it's just that imprisoning people is not the way to go. We have to educate them. We have to give them a means to live their lives, because most everybody's living in survival mode still. From, you know, and that's, if we're not talking about just CDCR or DOCs, but we're talking about, what about the prison, that's the emotional prison that we're trapped at such a young age, forced to live out into our future. And you got grown men acting out because they've never been told that this, you know, or educated on what to do with this. And they just, you know, that saying hurt people is so true to this day. And people don't realize that they're hurting, or they're hurting other people. And we have to, you know, get rid of the model, lock them up and throw away the key, and start embracing and saying, how can we help? And because to be honest, it's all turning into crap. It's evolving into something that is just kind of ran away from us, and we're losing out of touch with those people. Inmates are not inmates. They're human beings. They bleed, they crap, they breathe just like everybody else. As soon as we sit there and embrace them as human beings and as people that just made a bad choice and decision and they could be redeemed, we're in a better place. But they're not just put away, and they're not helped. We have to take charge. We have to put out programs. We have to show compassion. We have to show that, hey, you know what? You are not defined by your crime, but you are defined by what you do next. And that's what you have to do.
Yes.
So,
a lot of things that you have said within the last few minutes, without us even discussing it, are things I have put in my book. I mean, we have not even discussed these things, but clearly, you know, when those of us who are aligned in our beliefs and in our desperation basically to make change, you know, it's clear that we feel the same way on so many points.
But you know what it is? Yeah. It's just common sense. You know, if anybody's raised in a home that's full of love, they're going to have compassion on, if a crime is committed, they're going to have compassion for both the person who was the victim and the person who committed the crime. Because in most cases, offenders, they weren't born to commit a crime. Something had to happen along the way. So instead of people taking sides, what they need to do is be non-judgmental. They need to remain neutral, and they need to find out what caused this person to commit this offense, and they need to support the victims and the victims' families at the same time. What we live in today is not like that. It's not. We're not living in a society where people feel that way. Many have caused people to stumble, unfortunately. There are victims in prison. There are prisoners who were victims before becoming offenders. And the public doesn't realize that. They're so busy taking sides right away without even knowing what the individual is about, knowing nothing about the individual on either side, not knowing who the offender, anything about the offender, and not knowing anything about the person, the victim. Look at that one that was causing her boyfriend to commit suicide, and he ended up committing suicide.
Yeah.
Okay, unfortunately, if it turned around, it was reversed, and it turned out to be her, he would have been in prison. He's so depressed. We don't know what a person is really depressed about. Are they going to commit suicide, or are they going to commit homicide? And this is what we have to know. This is logic. You know, this is common sense. Anybody in this audience or in this country or in this world that can't see that something is wrong with them. We have victims and we have to stop being, we have to remain neutral. We have to stop being judgmental. We have to stop taking sides. As it says in the book of Exodus, Exodus 23, 1 through 3, do not go with the multitude to do evil against a poor man's cause. You know, we have to start becoming more sensitive to both sides, and we have to stop being so racist, so hateful, so judgmental, you know, so cold-hearted.
Yeah.
You know, we have to, like Lauren said, we all bleed the same. You know, we
yes,
all
we
bleed.
Do. Yes,
all,
we
every,
do. We all.
Across the world, every family across the world has something going on in their lives or with somebody that they care for that's going on with their lives, whether it be inside or outside. There are always many, many of God's people who are being harmed. God's people who are being going through trials and tribulations, who are being persecuted, who are being afflicted. We have to look at these things instead of being, who are we to judge? Jesus himself gave his life as a ransom sacrifice to forgive all men for sins. And yet they're still out there judging like they're God. No one should be judging anybody, especially without knowing that person. Look at Lawrence. He's been in and out of foster homes all these years. He comes out of prison. What does he do? He is now a pastor. He is now having an organization trying to help others. Isn't that what happened when Paul was on his way to Damascus to destroy more Christians and Jesus blinded him? And what did Paul do? Paul suffered more to help God's people, to help the brothers and sisters around the world. He did more. He took beatings. He ended up in prison. He did all these things. This is a man that even the Jewish people at the time hated, because he was with the Romans out there to persecute. And we still have problems with the government. Even maybe we're not in Rome, but the government is still a problem. And this is where we have to stop this.
Yes, we do. And you know, I'm reminded of a passage in the Bible where there was a prostitute, and they were there were several getting ready to stone her to death. And Jesus came, and he said, he looked at these people that were getting ready to stone this woman, Mary Magdalene. He said, "He who is without stone, cast the first. He who is without sin, the first stone." And he turned his back. And when he turned back around, they were gone because they knew they all had sinned.
They thought they were going to catch Jesus in a trick. The prostitute was running and ran into where Jesus was sitting on the ground. And those people thought they were going to catch Jesus in a trick. And they asked him what he would do. And that's when he wrote on the ground and he looked up at them and he said, "He who has not sinned, cast the first stone." And they were all, they all had to drop those stones and walk away, because they were all sinners. But we're living in
a society
where everybody thinks that they are the righteous ones. It's the righteous ones that will not make it. Those righteous who are judging, and who are abusing, and who are going along with the multitude to do evil. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Well, I remember growing up in church, you know, and my daddy was a preacher, and you know, everybody was dressed to the nines. Everybody was dressed up and just trying to look a certain way, and the conversation was, oh my goodness, I love that outfit, where did you get it? And you know, let's go out to dinner after services, and we'll go to this expensive restaurant. And you know, the thing is, that's so confusing to me, because I don't think appearance has anything to do with your soul and your spirit and what you want to accomplish. And yet that is how that went. You know, I think all are welcome. I think all are welcome to be loved by God, regardless of whether they have a $500 suit or not. And that's another problem in America, because America wants to show themselves as being, you know, they've got their expensive cars, they've got their nice homes, the American dream, in other words.
Materialistic is what they are. Instead of, look at when Jesus came into this world as a king, but yet he lowered himself below the homeless. You know, he was homeless. He was wearing a smock and you know, sandals and a robe. You know something? That's the problem with this country. We live in a materialistic country. That's why I would rather live in a poor country and enjoy myself. And like I said, give me my loved one. Let me go to one of these poorest countries. Because when I was in these countries that I traveled and I was in, they were slow. They didn't rush. They didn't have to rush like we do in this country. Everybody's rush. Everybody's about materialistic things. Everybody's about keeping up with the elite. You know, these are the things that people in this country are all about. Whereas other countries, they dress just like any average citizen. You know, they're very spiritual. They believe in God. They truly do. When I was in Guatemala, I went to church, and I was coming out of the church, and all the doors were open. You could hear the music playing and everything. I'd go from one to another to another. I was very much into studying about religion and cultures, and that's the one thing I learned, is that this country is the worst of all countries. This country is a materialistic, as I say, it's a hateful country. It's a who you know and what they say. Look at the media. I was surprised. They were talking about all these, you know, they put sports first. They put the, after the weather, sports.
Oh,
and then
sure.
And here there was a person that was missing. Instead of talking about that person first, they wanted to talk about the ducks or something, the beautiful ducks they saw out in the good weather. This is so abnormal. And they all want to dress the same. They all want to talk the same. It's all about them. It's not about the news. This is what I'm saying. This is the kind of country we live in. It's all about them. It's all about.
Yeah, and I could not agree more. I could not agree more. You know, I spoke with someone, an ally that lives in Africa, just last evening. He said, Sandy, what happened? What's going on in your country? Because we thought your country had it together. Why does your country not have it together? I said, you know, let me get back to you, because to tell you the truth, I have no idea. I have no clue. But when other people from other countries reach out to you and say, oh my gosh, the United States is a mess, can you explain to me? What's the proper answer there?
You know, first of all, Africa is a continent. There are many, many, many countries in Africa. The United States is a continent, but it's not countries, it's states. And yet the United States, you would think that we were living in different countries in each state, because nothing's consistent in the country, nothing.
No.
The problems are all the same across the country. The problems are the same, but everything is operated differently. The prison system is operated differently. The policies, the regulations, all of them is operated. This is the United States of America, one country. And it's so divided, it's so inconsistent. In Africa, you have 100-something countries. You know, I could see things being different. But in this country, forget it. No consistency at all. But getting back to the abuses of power.
Well, you know how I see it is, you know, doing 20 years in prison, you you see a lot of stuff, and it's no different out here. Is you have good inmates, you have bad inmates, you have good cops, you have bad cops in a broken system. And the thing is, it's like out here, you know, the government is like the COs, you know, they're corrupt. They're there to do their job. Supposedly they don't do it, but yet you have some good and some bad. And, you know, in prison, it was our job. That's how I gained my integrity within those walls, because of being oppressed. And it's like out here is the same thing. Is that what am I? So, you know, I was in prison. I was still doing what I was supposed to as far as helping the inmates. I was there as a peer mentor. I was an example. And out here, you know, it feels like that sometimes too. But while I was locked up, I still did good things for our people. I still, no matter what the conditions were, I still rose above. We have that ability out here too. You know, we make or break our communities. We are either the solution or the problem in our community. But if enough of us get together and lead by example and show what can be done, we can influence them. And it's no different than in there when I was going to all my groups and this guy would say, "Oh yeah, you're full of crap, Lawrence. You're fake just like everybody else." But like 6 months later, he'd say, "Man, you know what? You really had an impact in my life." And now he's one of my I mentor him. So it's like, why can't we do that out here? It's nothing's changed. It's just, I went from one prison to another, and to one, my yard is just bigger and I have more access than what I had before. So, you know, it's our job to rise above and to be that, that figure, to sit there and be a voice of change and to be a people of action. You know, we have that ability. We're not as helpless as we think we are out here. We are actually very influential and very powerful.
I love that, Lawrence. I do love that. You know, we have got to be proactive. Proactive is key. We can all sit and complain and wish things were different, but until we're willing to make a change, and I know Leona has had different things out there, such as let's do away with the prison systems and make rehabilitation centers. Some people, I understand, may never leave the rehabilitation center because of the crimes they've committed and because their mindsets are not going to be able to change. But there are so many who have honestly, they acquiesce to the fact that they did commit a crime, but they're willing to change. They're willing to learn, they're willing to grow, and they're willing to make a difference. And who are we to say you're not worthy?
Yeah, and we can't throw these people away. You know, these are going to be these are leaders in our communities if given the right opportunity. If you know, you have good examples. I have a pastor and his wife that show me how to be a good husband and good father. But you also have bad examples that create a goodness. You know, of what not to do. The other day, I was talking to some kids, and I was telling them about how, you know, growing up and starting from stealing candy led to stealing cars and burglarizing houses, and the impact that I had on just my example was astounding. It's necessary out here. People need to know what can happen and how, you know, where we go next. You know, that it doesn't end here. That it goes further. And to utilize the good and the bad in the world to for the greater good of humanity, it's necessary.
You know,
it
Lawrence,
is necessary. I know the show's about to end, but I'm going to say, you know, when we make mistakes, and we all make mistakes, you learn from those mistakes, and then you move forward, and you try to encourage others not to make those mistakes.
Absolutely.
So, I was going to ask you, have you ever thought of connecting with the Department of Youth Services? and yeah. talking to him about going to maybe to do some workshop or some group therapy or something with the young adolescents, the youth there?
You know, that's been something, it's been in my heart lately, and I'm going to pursue it through my business is youth diversion. And I think that it's impactful. You know, when you sit there and show somebody that did, when you're talking to a 13 and 12 year old kid and tell them that you did 20 years in prison for, and how it began, they can relate to it and they see how it's going to end. I think that's impactful, and that's why I say that we're not just trash. You can't just throw us away. You have to utilize the formerly incarcerated. You have to utilize the incarcerated, because that voice, you never know the impact and the influence that person's going to have. And so why aren't we embracing these people and utilizing that for the greater good, instead of sitting there going, oh, I don't feel safe. Let me tell you something. You don't feel safe. You should worry about the person that you don't know, instead of the person trying to prove themselves to be a better human being and putting all the cards on the table. But you'd rather trust the guy that lives next door that you don't know crap about, that the guy that you don't know anything, that's never said two words to you, but you trust him more than a guy that just came out of prison and has all his cards on the table, exhibiting the good factor, the good attributes of a decent human being. And that's what's wrong with the world today, is that judgment over truth. You know, it's just it's unfortunate. It's everybody is deemable. Everybody is redeemable in this sense. Nobody is trash. God does not make trash. And everyone deserves that second chance. And if you're not willing to give it to them, I am. And that's the problem, is we have to embrace these people and we have to learn how to work with them for something greater than ourselves, and quit being so selfish as individuals and for our own purposes and because of a title or whatever. Utilize everybody and everything. Leave people, places, and things better than you found them.
Okay, now I'd like to have you talk more right now, Lawrence, about how far you've come in your goal to start your business, to start getting this moving. And then we have like 7 minutes. And then after that, I'd like Sandy and you both to give your contact information, and any information you want the audience to know. But as far as the discussions you have made about going in, talking to these people and these adolescents or these juveniles or youth, however the audience or anyone wants to call them, What have you been able to do thus far in this area?
Right now, it's just networking and having somebody give me an opportunity. That seems to be the only barrier right now, is that I'm still being viewed as the incarcerated and somebody that did time. And there's a stigma attached to it, unfortunately, and there's nothing I could do about that. But, you know, that's why I figured what people won't do for me, I'll do myself. And it may take a little bit more time. Huh?
Let me ask you. Now, there's a lot of young people that are in community colleges right now and also in the universities that are going for child development. Some of them are going for social work. You know, some of them are going for counselors, psychology. I would start out at the community colleges. And I would actually contact them and speak to someone in charge about the opportunity to go in and to speak with some of those students that are going to school for to work with the adolescents. Also, I was going to say, in the summertime, they usually hold programs. They have these 12-week programs or 6-week programs where you can put in a proposal to have a workshop in the school put in a proposal of what your program would be. In your area, it would be speaking with having a workshop on the adolescents and the complications that come with being a juvenile or a youth, the issues that they have to face and sometimes the downfalls that they have to go through. And as somebody that has been through it all, you're going to be like the person that will be doing the workshop.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny you say that because I was just talking to somebody at the community college up here, and I asked them, I put my business out there, and I said, this is what we do. And I gave him a card, and it's funny you say that because I was like, hey, is there anything you can do with this? And he said, yeah, let me see. So things are in the works right now. You know, I got to keep in mind, I've only been out less than 4 months.
Yeah.
And I have an issue with technology and I'm good at talking and networking, but the technology is just a barrier right now that I'm working with myself on, and I got help from other people, but my sister-in-law helps me out a lot, my wife, even my son, and he's only 12 years old. So these are the things that I'm learning how to ask for help and be vulnerable.
I think what might help too is to try to find some of these former offenders who started their own businesses. If there's some way you can connect with others that came out of prison and started and they were successful, you could go on the internet and type in former inmates with businesses or former inmates with
nonprofits.
Oh, I'm going to do that. You know, it's just in this line of work, though, Leona, it's very difficult because everybody's very some people are very selfish, and they lost sight of the big picture, and they're not willing to let people in. And I've learned that, too, is that, some people just want to hang on to what they have.
Yeah, I've got to back you up on that. Being an advocate is not easy in this day and age. Because there are people that are going to want to take ownership of cases rather than inviting everybody else to help them. They want to take ownership. And unfortunately, I personally have had to come to the realization that if someone is not willing to work with me, then I have to move on because I can't let one individual
go ahead, Sandy. We don't have much time.
You go ahead.
Wanted to say nonprofit startups give former inmates new options. So, Lawrence, check out charitableadvisors.com. They have startup funding that they give former inmates to start up new businesses. There's also standout nonprofits in 2021. There's also Prison Healing Nonprofit Inside Circle Foundation. It's former inmates who started nonprofit organizations. It'll bring you up to a lot of these things. So that's
okay.
Where you,
I'll look it up right now.
It doesn't cost anything to research. It doesn't cost anything. And you want to put things like that in. Former inmates with businesses. Former inmates who started nonprofits. Or nonprofit organizations. A startup money for former. There's all kinds of resources, and I just typed in former inmates who started nonprofit organizations, and it's got a whole lot of stuff in there. Now we're down to a minute and a half. So, Lawrence, you want to first give your contact information?
Yeah, you could reach me at Legacy Programs Education and Reentry. You could contact me at Lawrence Drink, D as in David, R-E-N-K at gmail.com. And everything's there. I'm on Facebook as Sparky Lee, and we have the legacy programs on there as well. So feel free to lash out or whatever. You know, any type of interaction is good. Thank you.
Okay. And Sandy, you want to quickly give your information, your contact information as well?
Yes. My email is all lowercase, Sandy Freese. That is F as in Frank, R-E-E-S as in Sam, E, 63 at gmail.com. I am on LinkedIn as well as Lawrence. Also, I am on Twitter. My business is Victory from Chaos. You can find that on victoryfromchaos.com and on Facebook. That's pretty much it. Leona, I want to thank you so much for what you do.
I
want to thank you as well. Because you're both pivotal people.
Thank you.
I want to thank you both for being on, and I want to thank you both for covering for me because I had a couple of important phone calls that came through while I was trying to do the show. But I want to thank you both for being on. Once again, Lawrence, do me a favor and do that research for other former inmates who have actually started businesses or who have 501c3s or even the charitable organizations that give funding for startup businesses for nonprofits started by inmates. Thank you both, and I look forward to everybody. We will be back on next Sunday at 3:30 p.m. with Sandy Fries, life coach, therapist, and co-host, and also Lawrence Drank. I thank you both once again for being on. We are now going to end this episode. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank
God
you.
Bless you. Bye.